welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Turn the Page. I'm your host, Jen, today, and I am joined by a writer and a historian who I admire very much. This is a very exciting interview for me. So let's welcome to the show Eric Larson. Hello, welcome. Could you tell us a little bit about the book that you're here to talk about today?
Yeah, so this is my latest book, The Demon of Unrest. And it is nominally about the 5 months between Lincoln's election and the start of the Civil War. But it brings in a lot of characters who are not typically found in Civil War historiography. It's very much a pandemic book. If you want to talk about that, I'm delighted to. So anyway, there it is. I'm in a hotel room now in Washington after doing a big event last night at the Smithsonian, which was great fun.
Oh, wow. That's very cool. Yeah, there's been a lot of really interesting interviews and events around this book. And it does seem very timely in so many ways, which is something that you mentioned in the book as well. You were writing it not only during the pandemic, but while the events of January 6th were unfolding. How did all of that, the writing conditions during the pandemic and the political atmosphere, let's call it, how did that...
Let me address the political aspect first. You know, I was interested in this idea. I was already starting to work on it, but I was, as I often am, I wasn't completely committed to the idea. I'm often like that, like, you know, lack of confidence is sort of my superpower. You know, it makes me evaluate things over and over and over. And then came January 6th. Yeah, the events thereof. And suddenly I realized, wait a minute, this really is a story for our time. And that's what made me double down and really get into the story. When I say it was a pandemic book, what I mean is that back in 2020, if we can remember that, I was in the middle of my book tour for the Splendid and Vile book about Churchill. Literally halfway through when we all went into lockdown. I had to fly home on my wife's birthday. And so suddenly, you know, we're out at our Long Island redoubt, you know, pandemic redoubt. And I found myself with a lot of extra time that I had not expected to have. So I started thinking about the next book idea, looked into a variety of things, stumbled across this amazing trove of documents that covered this inexorable drive toward the Civil War. This is the first volume of a collection called The War of the Rebellion, the Official Records of the Union and Confederate Armies. I ordered a bound volume of volume one, which of course was the volume I needed. And after disinfecting it and so forth, I started reading this collection. And it was really incredibly compelling. Here's this, you know, exquisitely curated in terms of chronological order. Here were hundreds of documents, letter response, telegram response, and so forth, all leading up to this you know, ultimate tragedy of the Civil War. And I'm not often that lucky to find that kind of ready-made spine, if you will, for my books. So that got me kind of galvanized. But the one problem I had with the pandemic, my usual MO is when I get to that point where I think I'm going to do something, where I think I'm going to do a book, my usual MO is to go right away to some physical archive somewhere with no pre-planning, just dive in and see what's available. It really is helpful for jumpstarting things, you know, after I've gone through the whole book proposal process and so forth. I was not able to do that because of the pandemic. The key archives were closed, and God knew I was not going to fly anywhere or take a train anywhere, you know, in peak pandemic. So I had to rely on these online repositories of documents, which was kind of a drag on the one hand. I don't like online research. On the other hand, for this era, there are some really nicely done digital archives, like the Lincoln Papers at the Library of Congress, a collection called The Complete Works of Lincoln, Seward's Letter, you know, William Henry Seward's letters, and his correspondence with his wife, which is incredibly interesting. So there were all these things that helped me at least at least, you know, engage the subject until the pandemic lessened enough that I could actually get to the Library of Congress mm-hmm. and to the Charleston Historical Society.
Wow, that's fascinating. And I can really sympathize because I finished a dissertation during the pandemic, which was incredibly hard being separated from your sources. but speaking of sources, because something that this book does really well, I think, is, you know, in the lead up to the war, there's a lot of distinctions made between what people were saying and doing publicly and what they were saying and doing privately. And you've talked a little bit about the sources that you've used. Could you talk about, you know, maybe comparing the two source sets, or like, what did you use for the sort of the political performative side, if you want to call it, and for the more private domestic side?
Yeah. So I really wanted to have a rich palette in this book, because, you know, my goal, you mentioned that I was a historian. I actually don't think of myself as a historian per se, and I'm sure there are historians who feel that way about me. My goal, I see myself more as a historical journalist, and my goal is to create as rich a historical experience for readers as I possibly can by bringing in as many sources as I can, with the ideal being that readers will sink into the book, sink into the past, and ideally not emerge until they finish the book. And when they do emerge, they have a feeling of having lived in that past time. I mean, I've heard from readers now who tell me that the especially the closing chapters, closing elements are incredibly, incredibly, incredibly powerful and moving to them. And that's what I'm after. So what that meant was, here I had this spine, these documents, you know, from the War Department, from, you know, the Confederacy, from the commander in charge of Fort Sumter and so forth, all this really detailed stuff. But I wanted a richer sense of the time. So I have two great villains. One is James Henry Hammond, a senator, U.S. senator, well, first a congressman, then a U.S. senator from South Carolina, who has this incredibly salacious diary in which he confesses to having a sexual dalliance with his four of his nieces, all at once, mind you, and also sleeping with his two of his enslaved women, you know, and yet he was one of the foremost evangelists for what was called the pro-slavery ethos, the thing that made the South persuade itself that slavery was not a bad thing. It was, in fact, a very good thing. And it was very good also for the enslaved Blacks, because it kept them from the tyranny of wage slavery in the North. Yeah, some argument there. So he had to be in this book. Another character, Edmund Ruffett, also a villain, absolutely hated the North, hated Yankees, was just full of hatred for anything even evoking the North. And he went around endorsing, promoting secession wherever he possibly could. And actually, he was one of the first to. A lot of people in this era, you know, yes, there was this conflict, but they didn't really understand. They didn't think that it would lead to a major war, a major conflict. Edmund Ruffin was one of the few who seemed to be able to see into the future with a certain amount of more clarity, maybe because he was so filled with hatred. That's how he interpreted what the future would look like. So he writes this book called Anticipations of the Future, which, you know, the climax of the book is Southern forces overrunning New York City, burning every single house, the charred corpses in the streets. and that's his vision. Didn't sell very well, and actually it was a terrible book, but he has a very important role in the end, which I don't want to reveal.
Yeah. The villains are fascinating, and so are the, I guess, what you might call the protagonists, or, you know, the who we are on the side that we perhaps as modern readers more identify. I'd love for you to talk a little bit about choosing Major Robert Anderson as your sort of grounding figure for a lot of the narrative, not only around Fort Sumter for obvious reasons, but around the lead up to that. So could you talk a little bit about him and maybe what drew you to him as your sort of grounding character?
Yeah, well, he's sort of, I mean, metaphorically and not so metaphorically, he sort of came to me. I mean, he had to be a central character. Major Robert Anderson was was placed in charge of federal presence in Charleston Harbor well before Lincoln, well, not yet, was he there before Lincoln's election or after? I'm fuzzy on that date. But anyway, he was placed in charge of federal forces in Charleston Harbor. Very likely he was placed there because he was very sympathetic to the South. He was Southern born. He was a former slave owner. His wife was from Georgia. Her father was a very famous Georgian planter and also a Revolutionary War hero. There's a lot of speculation that the War Department put him in command at Charleston so that he might be more inclined to smooth things over or meet even the sort of darker conspiracies. He might be more inclined to give up the forts and so forth under pressure. Total misunderstanding of Major Anderson, who was incredibly loyal, not so much to the United States, but to the United States Army, and to a degree that could not be shaken. And that was sort of the setup. And Major Anderson is such a cool character because he's just sort of, he's initially in Fort Moultrie, which is one of the federal forts in Charleston Harbor, secretly moves himself and this very small garrison of his, 75 soldiers, secretly at night on the day after Christmas, moves into Fort Sumter, which infuriated South Carolina, absolutely infuriated South Carolina, and really intensified the conflict. But here's Major Anderson. Now he's at Fort Sumter, which is a classic sea fortress. It's a very large, forbidding structure surrounded by water. It is as yet incomplete at this point. It's been under construction since 1828, and we're talking now 1860. It is supposed to house 650 men. He's got 75. Many of the guns that will eventually be in this fort are just lying around on the parade ground within the fort. His mission is he's got to bring this fort up to speed with that minimal number of soldiers and get those guns in place, because he knows that something very bad could potentially happen. And I've thought about this a lot, that here's our major Anderson at this fort. Over time, after he occupied the fort, the Southern forces and eventually Confederate forces began building gun batteries on every available piece of land near enough to the fort to hit it. So here you are, imagine yourself, Major Anderson, here you're in this fort, you're in the middle of Charleston Harbor, and suddenly you are surrounded by really heavy artillery from all directions. And as the stuff is being established, put in place, you can actually hear the construction underway. I mean, it's like I think to myself that it has to have been a lot like, if you were a lamb tied to a post, and you're watching the butcher who's going to slaughter you, that's, and in fact, actually it had a serious toll on Major Anderson's health. And I believe, even though I wouldn't say it in the book, but his diagnosis by his doctor at the end of this whole story was pretty much a definition of post-traumatic stress syndrome. But anyway, so that's our major.
Mm. I'd love if you could also talk about the concept of Southern chivalry. My work was in medieval history, so I'm really fascinated by the South and the Confederacy's relationship to medieval history and how they interpret it. So could you talk about Southern chivalry and perhaps how this maybe contributed to the breakdown in the lead up to the war?
Very important part of the story is this question of honor and chivalry. I mean, It was really, really an eye-opener to me to read into this. I mean, I heard some of this stuff and I thought, that can't possibly be the case, but they referred to themselves, the planter aristocracy of South Carolina, referred to themselves as the chivalry. And they were devoted readers of the works of Sir Walter Scott and Tennyson and a writer named George, I forget his middle name, George Sims, who also wrote chivalrous works. They embraced this ethos to the point where they would actually hold what were called rings tournaments, or even more macabre, heads and rings tournaments, where the chivalry, the planters, would dress up like knights, their favorite knight from Ivanhoe or whatever, which was written by Sir Walter Scott, charged down this course with a lance. Now, they weren't actually jousting because, you know, they could kill each other with an actual lance with a knife at the end. But they would charge down this course, and the goal was to pierce a ring hanging along the court, and that was a measure of your prowess on horseback and also your aim with this lance. By the time you got to the end of the course, if this was a heads and rings tournament, you were supposed to pull out your saber and hack away at an inanimate figure at the end of the thing. So this shows how much they were into this whole chivalry thing. And the whole, you mentioned, you know, studying medieval history. I mean, there really was this sort of almost sense like, you know, the kind of wish they were back in the days of King Arthur. The reason this is important, because this whole question of honor, two very important shift was happening in the world. In 1808, the United States actually banned the international slave trade. Allowed the domestic trade to continue, but banned the international trade. And in doing so, it was actually part of this global movement away from slavery led by Britain. So you have the world moving away from slavery. You have the North becoming more and more ardent about its opposition to slavery, the rise of abolitionists. Garrison's newspaper, The Liberator, is founded in 1830, his anti-slavery society. So this heated criticism of slavery. Meanwhile, in the South, I mean, the South was utterly dependent on slavery. And don't let anybody tell you it was not about slavery. It was. You can couch it in terms of states' rights, but in the end, it was about slavery. So here's the North attacking the underpinnings of Southern culture and society. So in the South, a very interesting thing happened. Initially, even Southerners felt that slavery was sort of a necessary evil. But then they sort of shook that off and became devoted to this concept that I'd mentioned earlier, the pro-slavery ethos, the idea that no, slavery is actually a positive good. And James Henry Hammond led the charge on that one. So you had the South becoming more and more convinced that they were on the side of the angels in keeping slaves. And you had the North telling them, no, you're on the side of the devil. And by doing so, the North was not just criticizing the South. It was besmirching the personal honor of these Southern men. And that could not be countenance. That really fed fuel into the fire of conflict in the South.
It's so fascinating. And I think it's a good reminder that even when you're looking back at history, those people were all shaped by how they interpreted the history that happened before them. And that's always at play in the present. But thank you so much for talking to us on our show today. This book is really fascinating. And it was such an honor to get to talk to you about it. Thank you.
Hey, pleasure. Long Island, Semper Fi. I grew up in Freeport.
Oh, excellent. Oh, yes. We're very close by. So... All right, listeners, it's now your turn. Please check out The Demon of Unrest. It's a beautiful, riveting book. You're going to really enjoy it. And by the time that you hear this, it's out. It's out now. Thank you so much for joining us. It is now time to close this chapter.
It's time to close this chapter of Turn the Page. Join us for the next episode.